for the season now, and in their burrows, you know, waiting to hibernate for the winter. There's still some unanswered questions. Barry and I had a great theory as to where the females laid their eggs, and it turned out to be completely wrong. And that was a great moment. It brought me back to those science fair days when, you know, you set up a theory and then you tested it. And in my science fair days, I was usually right. I kind of arranged it that way. But as a real scientist, you have to expect to be wrong. That's okay. So I still have some work to do to answer those questions. And I'm thinking maybe about the oscillated tiger beetle. Who knows? I might move on to another species.
It's interesting to try to think of all the different species that we don't know about that someone could become interested in.
And that science doesn't know about. I mean, there are new species, you know, being discovered. We'll put that in quotes. They were there all along, but, you know, we're finding out about them. No, you know, there's all kinds of ways you can engage that you would be a discoverer, an explorer. And again, that's kind of exciting.
Sharman Apt-Russell, author of Diary of a Citizen Scientist, Chasing Tiger Beetles and Other New Ways of Engaging the World. Thank you so much for speaking about this with us here on KBOO.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
And thank you for listening to KBOO Portland. We're going to go right to the bike show.
Good morning and welcome to the KBOO Bike Show. My name is Alon Rab, and I'm joined by co-host Tori Bortman. Good morning, Tori.
Good morning, Alon.
And our engineer is, as always, Tammy Dean. Good morning, Tammy. Today is KBOO's Day of Broadcasting, devoted to turning the tide on climate change and what we could do to avert a global catastrophe. The bicycle has had an important role to play in the struggle, and we could talk for hours about its low carbon imprint, its role in reducing pollution, not requiring wars for oil and empire in order to finance its operation, and its contribution to a sense of community, joy, and freedom, all essential if we are to reclaim our world. Today we will talk about some important roles bicycles play in making our world safer and more peaceful for all. Our first guest is Shannon Galpin, human rights activist, founder of the Mountain to Mountain nonprofit, which works to empower women and girls in conflict zones, and author. Her inspiring and powerful book, Mountain to Mountain, has just been published by St. Martin's Press, and she will present it this Friday at 7:30 at Powell's Books. Later in the show, we will speak with Emma Stocker, business continuity and emergency management planner at the University of Oregon and member and past chair of the Lane County Preparedness Coalition, about how bicycles are an essential part of preparing for natural and human-made disasters. Shannon, welcome to the show, and thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'll start with asking you a big question. What does your foundation do? How did you get involved with this work, and why Afghanistan?
Oh, that is a big question.
And we only have half an hour, so.
I'll keep it quick. The nutshell version is I founded this foundation, Mountain to Mountain, specifically to work with women and girls in conflict zones. And for the last 6 years, that has been solely in Afghanistan. And I chose Afghanistan because it is repeatedly ranked the worst country in the world to be a woman. And I felt like if I was going to enter this fight against gender violence and for women's rights, why not start there?
That's and had you been there before?
No, I had not. I had lived briefly in the Middle East. I had traveled through Syria. I lived in Beirut. I had lived in Europe for 10 years. before that and was very comfortable traveling and certainly traveling solo. And I chose Afghanistan and literally talked to a good friend of mine who had been a photographer in Afghanistan, and she connected me with her translator and fixer and her travel agent in New York, who at the time was able to arrange to get me to Kabul, because now it's a lot easier. But 6 years ago, even, you couldn't get on Travelocity and book a ticket.
Right.
And what exactly is the status of girls and women in Afghanistan when you talk about it being the worst in the world? What are you talking about? What's happening?
Well, in Afghanistan, it's interesting. And, you know, predominantly in the rural communities, which is the majority of the country that live in rural communities, the status for women is quite grim. Women are, you know, still kind of sold and traded, you know, as wives from a very young age. They are often required to wear burqas and aren't allowed to leave their home without a male escort. You know, education is quite poor. And, you know, there's a stark contrast with women in the urban communities like Kabul, where you have women running as members of parliament. They're activists. They're even running as president and vice president candidates. And education level is quite high and through university level. But that, unfortunately, is just not the majority of women. That's still kind of the anomaly in Afghanistan.
So how did you, when you got to Afghanistan, which sounds like it was actually just a huge step, and then how did you decide to go about starting your work? How did you kind of decide, were bicycles always a part of the plan?
No, bicycles were actually never part of the plan. I am a biker. I'm a mountain biker, predominantly single speed. And I've always loved bikes. But biking was never part of the plan in Afghanistan because it's one of the few countries in the world where women cannot ride bikes. It's controversial. It's taboo. It literally could bring dishonor to families because it is considered such a taboo. And so that was never entry into my mindset. But I was very curious that in a country that has been moving forward and where girls are boxing, girls are skateboarding, again, in urban communities, the girls are playing volleyball, biking was still so controversial. And so it was really not entry into my plan. I was working at, you know, more kind of quote-unquote traditional projects, girls' education. We built a school for the deaf, computer labs for girls, and started working with artists. Contemporary artists and graffiti artists.
So how did the bike suddenly get involved?
So I started biking myself in 2009. And I did that because I realized that there was this very unique role that foreign women play in countries like Afghanistan, where we are kind of this neutral gender or a hybrid gender, where I am not a man, but I'm also not just a woman. I'm allowed to get away with a lot more. So I started mountain biking in Afghanistan as, one, a way to experience the country that I was falling in love with and working and dedicating, you know, my life to in a different way. You know, I mean, when we explore the landscape on two wheels, it's completely different. And the interactions you have with locals is completely different. And that's no different in Afghanistan. But I wanted to be able to start to raise the question and understand why girls couldn't ride bikes, mainly because I was curious, could that shift? And therefore, if bikes became normal for girls, just like they are for boys, could we get girls in rural communities on bikes to go to schools in villages and have better access to education? Could we get midwives on bikes to increase their capacity to serve their communities? And could we use it as a tool against gender violence so that girls, especially young girls who have hit puberty, would have independent means of travel? And so the bike for me became a very personal icebreaker and a way to have those conversations.
So when you come into a village as a hybrid male, as you described, and you're sitting for coffee with the elders of the village or the males in the family, how do you move from that step to actually getting girls and women on bikes? Do you have to convince the males, or how does it work?
So what I did was I never brought the bike into the programming. I allowed the bike to be the icebreaker, to share my culture, to learn about theirs, to follow up their invitations for tea or dinner with their families and understand and essentially learn more. I never pushed on the bike because the reaction was always, we're okay with you biking, but it's not our culture. It's not appropriate for our girls. And so I assumed that I would continue with the work that I was doing in other ways and not focus on the bike. But in 2012, I was in Kabul and was introduced to a member of the men's cycling team. And I had no idea that there had been a men's cycling team. And after meeting him, who ironically has the same name as the new president, Ashraf Ghani is the name of the young man on the men's team. He told me that he invited me for a ride with the men's team and told me that there was a girls' team. So I immediately met with a coach and started supporting that team. And through that kind of organic transition, it never became a Western idea. It was always an Afghan-led idea that they took on at their pacing and I now support.
In your book, you write about your struggles and suffering and how a quote that you say is, I didn't make the choices I made easily. I take the financial and physical risks because I believe in what I'm doing, and I believe it can serve as an inspiration to my daughter. There's no excuse for not being involved, whether that's in your community or halfway around the world. I want to talk a little bit about those risks that you take there and what that looks like for you.
Mm-hmm.
So is it a physical risk? Oh, go ahead. Sorry about that.
No, I mean, there's definitely a physical risk. I mean, I spend a good portion of my time in Afghanistan mitigating risk so that I am doing things as safely and making the best choices every single day, every single hour that I can, because I am a mother and because I want to continue doing the work I do. I certainly have taken financial risks. That affects me here and there, whether that is with programming or whether that's on a personal level with how I raise my daughter and how we live. But I know that a lot of people look at Afghanistan and, look at the physical risks, the security risks, and wonder, how can you make those choices? And I really am very aware that I've been to Afghanistan now 19 times in the past 6 years. And while there have been close calls, randomness of suicide bombs and roadside bombs and things like that, I have never been targeted. And that doesn't mean that I take it for granted. Certainly doesn't mean that I get complacent. I certainly am constantly being aware. But the most violence I've ever experienced and that my family has ever experienced has been in the U.S., and that is the attack of both my sister and myself in different states.
That's really interesting. Go ahead, Alon.
Yeah, one of my acquaintances is a man from Portland, originally from Afghanistan, Zahir Wahab. I don't know if you know him, but he went back to Kabul and he's teaching university students to be teachers. And he's in Kabul, but it seems like a lot of the students have been injured by, attacks and bombings and airstrikes by the Americans also. What is happening in the country right now? I mean, are you optimistic about its prospects?
Well, I'm feeling more optimistic now that they have inaugurated the next president. That helps enormously to be able to start to move forward, because there has been a backslide since 2011, 2012, where security has progressively gotten worse to the point where my trips this year in the spring and summer felt radically different. I felt incredibly lucky to be riding bikes with the girls' team. I felt incredibly lucky to be kind of out on the roads. But it wasn't like previous trips where I walk through Kabul or have that sense of there are safe areas and not safe areas. The sense of security deteriorating is palpable, as is the mass exodus of expats as security has continued to derail. And so you do have, roadside bombs,
whether that's in Kabul or out on the highways, you've got kidnappings, you have the violence that affects all of the areas that are currently battle zones with Taliban and international forces and Afghan forces. And so there are really wide black and white extremes between the areas that feel quite safe and the areas that are that are a war zone.
You've challenged your audience to see beyond victimhood of girls and women and see their courage and hear their voices. And I would love to hear a little bit more about some of the individual girls that you've worked with and maybe just what their daily life looks like and how the cycling fits into that daily part of their life or weekly part of their lives.
Sure. I mean, with the cyclists in particular, I've got to spend a lot of time with them on the bike and off, and because I am helping produce a documentary about the women's team with a Seattle filmmaker, Sarah Menzies, I've had that ability to go beyond the training and kind of the logistics, but also spend time with their families and kind of learn more of what they're doing in their private lives. And one woman in particular, Nazifa, is very young, very petite, very sweet. You know, she's just this kind of cutie pie that you just want to wrap up. And she has a couple of younger siblings. She started riding, and we found out that her father had been killed. Her uncle is kind of the patriarch of the family, but he comes back and forth between London and Kabul. He's a cab driver in London. So she started riding when she was in high school, and this past spring and summer, she told me that she will be enrolling into midwifery school. She wants to be a midwife and wants to help deliver babies in a country like Afghanistan, where the maternal and infant mortality rates are some of the highest in the world. That's a profession that she can be very successful with. There's an extreme need for midwives, and she could actually support a family that way. She wants to continue to bike ride through school, and she's one of the girls that has really expressed a desire to ride in the Olympics. Whether or not that is possible, you know, the next Olympics that would be even potential for her to get ready for would be the 2020.
Right.
Lots of change. In Afghanistan, she could get married. Her husband could not allow her to ride a bike. She could get so immersed in her studies and her future job that she doesn't, you know, make the time. Who knows? And also, these girls are very amateur. You know, the Olympics are not a possibility. Right now, they cannot finish longer races internationally, but they're there learning and competing and gaining skills, which then ripple out to inspire and engage other Afghan girls.
Yeah, I would think that it would be hard with a lot of the in my imagination of what the restrictions are of where you can ride and how far you can ride with the security problems, that it would be hard to find the time or even the places to go train for that kind of level of.
Yeah, that's actually the biggest problem, because you have so few training areas in terms of paved roads. But then if you do start to increase that access, particularly a lot of the highways and side roads off the highways, you've got to be able to get the girls there. And so a big solution that we've realized could eliminate one obstacle would be to get them a minibus, so that coach can essentially pick all the girls up, have all the bikes on top of the minibus, and be able to take a whole, 15 to 20 girls and bikes out to other areas that are safe, and also to vary where they're training, so it's also harder to be targeted. Whereas right now, he can only take four or five girls, and then the other girls try to find male family members that can, maybe drive a car and pick them up and take them. But it's just the logistics of that are very difficult, and that limits their abilities. Another solution we've thought about is indoor trainers. And while that's a great solution, especially like all of us do that, through the winter months.
Right.
It's also incredibly boring, and it defeats the whole point. It's great for the girls who are on the team who are wanting to race and train, but for the girls who are simply learning to ride bikes, the joy of being outside is the freedom. It is that wind in your face, and so really the best way is to just get more bikes, more access for the girls, and a minibus.
And one of the themes in your book and also your work seems to be demonstrating that victims are much more than the act which define them, and victims could be catalysts for change. And I think that's, you know, a very powerful message. Can you talk a little bit about how that manifests itself in your work, and especially in Afghanistan?
Definitely. It's something that certainly I see manifested in both my sister and myself, who are both, quote unquote, you know, victims of gender violence, but neither one of us are victims. We're both incredibly strong, very independent women. We're both athletes. And we both have found that we have more strength than we have weakness. And I see that in Afghanistan as well. I feel that there's this kind of, deep well of strength and resilience in Afghan women that I recognize that is coming from a life where, you know, most Afghan women have experienced some form of violence, whether that is a full-blown, assault, or whether it's violence against the family, whether it's a relocation because of the war. They have really shown themselves to be much more than victims. And the women that I see particularly as a great example, who are members of parliament, I mean, these are women that have endured so much. I mean, they're women who have grown up under Taliban control often. They have suffered. They have perhaps lived as refugees for a short period of time in Pakistan and come back. Many have been abused. Many have been attacked. Many now, as members of parliament, face daily or at least weekly threats because they are women and because they are members of parliament and have power. You know, they are often attacked and for that, or their families are threatened. And what I see with those women is a refusal to back down, a refusal to be quiet. You know, these are kind of the instigators of this generation, and they are the ones who are really trying to speak up for women, but also not just for women's rights. And a lot of members of parliament, you know, talk about that, female members of parliament. You know, we don't want to just be talking about women's issues. We are members of parliament. We want to be talking about the issues that make our country better. How do we achieve peace?
Those are women's issues. All of it, like the issues that affect all of them are the issues that affect women.
Exactly.
Can you talk a little bit more about the new film coming up, The Afghan Cycles?
Yeah, the documentary is still in progress. The filmmaker, Sarah Menzies, is actually going to be finishing up the production. And we originally had wanted to release in 2015, but the story is kind of unfolding in real time beyond the Afghan national team. We have two different pockets of young girls, completely unaware that there was a national team, that started teaching each other to ride bikes. There's a young girl who is actually in high school in the U.S., who came back to Kabul this summer to see her family and to be back in Afghanistan. And she taught a group of young girls in Kabul how to ride bikes. And then there's another girl in Bamiyan who learned to ride bikes as a young girl in Iran. And when they moved back to Afghanistan after the Taliban were pushed out, she started teaching girls to ride bikes in Bamiyan. And I met her this past summer.
And did you find them, or did they find you?
I found them. I mean, I found out about them and then reached out to
them. Okay, yeah.
They, they basically are doing what we've seen in a lot of other cultures, but just maybe 100 years later, where you see, just like in the U.S., that women who ride bikes are labeled immoral and promiscuous. Same in the U.K., same in France, same in America. Just at the turn of the century, the late 1800s. But then as more and more women start to ride and it becomes more normal, it usually segues a women's rights movement. And in the U.S., it's a perfect setup where you see women starting to ride bikes. They're labeled immoral and promiscuous. And pretty soon, the bike becomes a symbol of freedom because it is freedom of mobility. And the suffragettes in the women's rights movement adopts bike essentially as their symbol, and literally and figuratively. And, you know, I see this happening in Afghanistan. Whether or not that can really take root because of security is yet to be seen. You know, there's a good chance that women's rights will start to slide backward if security does not hold in Afghanistan, which would be incredibly tragic. But you have girls that are very aware that we have the rights, the same as our brothers, to ride a bike. What is the difference? And that's fascinating to be able to watch unfold very organically, with, you know, being led by Afghans, not by Westerners.
And the film is kind of following those two groups of girls that you mentioned? Or is it also
exactly
following the national team as well?
Yeah, the focus is the national team. But we wanted to show that this is spreading beyond that. And the goal of the film is to be a feature-length film that would premiere in 2016 now, which gives us just a little bit more time to watch this period of time unfold. As well as it being a period of transition, we decided we wanted to kind of watch this period a little bit longer.
I am writing a book about the history and culture of cycling in the Middle East, and a couple of the chapters are about women cyclists in the Middle East in the 1890s, 1920s, and today. And it's exciting that, you know, I've been in contact with groups, as an Egyptian group of women called We Want to Ride, who have been very vocal and protesting and demonstrating. And obviously every country is different, but it's really exciting that there seems to be a general movement across the Middle East, Afghanistan, for women to ride and, you know, assume a more equal place in society. So I'm really looking forward to this film also. How have you been changed by your work? I mean, what did you actually learn about, you know, yourself by being there?
Oh, I think in most of these cases, I'm certainly more changed from doing this work than probably even I have been effective doing the work. I don't know if I would have found my voice as an activist embracing kind of the fight against gender violence had I not spent the time I did in Afghanistan, and in particular the time that I spent in women's prisons. I really do realize that my voice solidified, and I guess I just owned my own story, warts and all, because of the time that I spent, particularly in the Kandahar women's prison. But over the course of 4 years of visiting multiple prisons multiple times, you know, I realized how powerful voice is, how powerful owning your own story is, and having the ability to share your experience and have someone listen. Because a lot of these women in the prisons have been through, you know, atrocious, violent past and survived and are living in prison, as victims, you know, and instead of their perpetrators going to jail, they go to jail to save honor for the families. And it's an incredibly unjust system right now, and not because Afghanistan's constitution is that way, but more so because there's not enough lawyers, not enough judges. You know, there's a breakdown in how the rulings come down. And
Shannon, we're running out of time here. We only have about a minute and a half left, but I want to make sure we get to talk about your next project, which is Strength in Numbers. You just mentioned solidifying and having a voice, and I want you to be able to tell our listeners a little bit about Strength in Numbers.
Strength in Numbers, very quickly, is the offshoot and the development from my work in Afghanistan, realizing the power of voice, realizing the strength that we all feel and the freedom we all feel riding bikes, and how the bike literally is a vehicle for social justice. And so Strength in Numbers is founded on the belief that while one person can make a change, there is strength in our numbers. And we could create an army of activists, an army of women, an army of cyclists that literally could change the world.
And how can our listeners help support all this excellent and important work that you're doing?
So the website is mountaintomountain2.org. Listeners can donate, which helps fund the programs. They can learn more on that website. They can also learn more at shannongalpin.com, which also has a link to the book and information around that. And you certainly come out in Portland.
Yeah, and you're...
questions.
And she's going to be at Paul's on Friday evening.
7:30.
At 7:30 p.m. Shannon, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been an honor.
Oh, thank you for having me. I can't wait to be back in Portland.
Thank you. You are listening to Community Radio KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. The show is The Bike Show. We just spoke with Shannon Galpin. And this week is Pledge Drive, so we will turn the mic over to Pledge Central.
Thanks very much. My name is Justin, and I'm joined by Pear, and it is indeed the first day of our fall membership drive, and we're asking everybody to get involved and to take a small bit of responsibility to ensure this kind of information is going out every hour of every day around the world. The Bike Show is clearly one of the reasons that Portland is one of the most bike-friendly cities anywhere, and we're asking you to show some support right now. You can call us up and introduce yourself at toll-free 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KBOO. And we're asking everyone to consider starting an electronic fund transfer, to start making an ongoing sustaining donation of any amount that works for you. But what we would like to have you think about is if you were going to give $60, perhaps, that you would start that that sustaining membership and do it as 12 installments of $5 a month. This is our goal. We have a goal. We're about $70,000 to go. We're already 10 grand into towards our goal on this first day of our membership drive. It's an abbreviated drive, only 10 days. So we want to make sure that we keep a focus going with 10 days to go. It means we need to be very consistent, and your radio station needs to hear from many voices in the community to make sure it can continue providing this valuable community service. Toll free 877-500-5266 or online at kboo.fm.
Or get on your bike and ride right down here to 20 Southeast 8th. There are little bike racks right out in front to park your bike. Come on in and see us. See where your money is going. Meet the people, see our lavish corporate headquarters, have a little bit of lunch. Oh, hey, we just got a couple of books here. Hey, these are nice, Mountain to Mountain. Wow. That's an attractive book.
Right.
Shannon Galpin.
We've been hearing from Shannon Galpin, and this book is Mountain to Mountain. I'm going to guess, I don't have information in front of me, I'm going to guess that a $60 gift or $5 a month electronic funds transfer, I'm told we only have one copy. This is quite lovely. She's riding, on the cover here, she's riding her bike in Afghanistan. This is a lovely looking book. $5 a month, we'll put that book into your hands. There's only one copy, so you could call right now, toll free, 877-500-5266, 877-500-KBOO. I want to thank Tori in Northeast Portland, who's renewing her membership. And we have another book here. Looks like just one copy, The Global Game, Writers on Soccer. This is edited by John Turnbull, Tom Satterley, and Alon Rahm. John Turnbull has done a lot of work over the years. If I remember correctly, he's a very accomplished anthropologist. This looks like a very, very good book for those who have a love for the beautiful game. This is The Global Game, and it looks to me like it's Writers on Soccer. That could be yours, $60. Perhaps you could start a $10 a month electronic funds transfer, and we could send you both of those copies. You could start that membership online at kboo.fm, or you could call us toll-free 877-500-5266.
And we are the beautiful radio station right down here at 20 Southeast 8th. Modest little building with nice mural on the front and room for parking your bike. Come on down and see us. Lay a little money on us or set up an electronic funds transfer so you can go through our list of premiums. We have all kinds of thank you gifts and some wonderful books here. Looks like they're going to go fast. There's only one of each, but they're very attractive books.
And the real thank you
there's a hoodie, too. The hoodie.
There is.
Make a fashion statement. Be a fashion statement.
This is just unrolling. Today is the first day we're talking about this. It's a brand new KBOO hoodie. It's black. It has a new logo with a star and a radio tower. It's very lovely looking. And in keeping with our notion of starting more sustaining memberships, that monthly giving program, this will be available in limited quantities for everyone who signs up for a $20 a month or more electronic funds transfer. It's $20 a month. I think you'll find out, look at that, $5 a week. I mean, you're looking at less than a dollar a day, if my math comes out right. And you will be the first on your block because fashion should be a statement and not a question. But I would like to remind you that we didn't make it over 46 years here by, giving away books and hoodies. We made it by making cutting-edge programming, training volunteers, thousands and thousands of volunteers, and reaching hundreds of thousands, if not millions of listeners around the world with news, public affairs, information, commentary, information that you don't get anywhere else that's designed to entice, enthuse, educate, enrage, entertain, and so much more. And we're asking you to put a small price on that. We give it away, but we ask you to do the right thing, to say, you know, this is worth something, and I want to make sure that the entire community, indeed the entire world, has access to this information, particularly on this first day of our membership drive and on our day of special programming involving the environment. We're asking you to get involved right now. You can do that online at kboo.fm. You can do that from anywhere on earth, and anywhere you're streaming, you're already there. So give it a click and start an EFT. You can also call us toll-free from anywhere in North America right now and introduce yourself. 877-500-KBOO.
Thank you, Pledge Central. In the studio are Tori Bortman and Alon Robb, your bike show hosts. In the first half of the show, we spoke with Shannon Galpin about her Mountain to Mountain Foundation and her work with girls and women in combat zones. Our next guest is Emma Stalker, Business Continuity and Emergency Management Planner at the University of Oregon, and a member and past chair of the Lane County Preparedness Coalition. Good morning, Emma.
Good morning.
How are you today?
Oh, it's great. It's sunny down here in Eugene, so it's a good day.
So no disasters today? Not yet.
Nope.
Before we start and hear about the work you're doing, I'm curious about your own background. How did you get involved in this kind of work?
Well, I did a lot of research about community recovery after Hurricane Katrina, and I met at the same time the fields of disaster response and recovery and emergency management, and also city planning and land use planning and community development. And so for me, I feel like I found a way to work sort of at the intersection of those two fields. And so, I've been working at the University of Oregon here for about 4 years now and working on building the resilience of this little community here on campus, but also connecting our community with local resources and building our partnerships with our city and our county and our state and our other higher ed partners. So that's a little bit about me.
So are you also involved in cycling?
I am a cyclist. I commute by bike, absolutely. And I've done a little bit of racing, mostly friends to and from the bars here in Eugene, but a couple of triathlons myself. And I'm actually one of the founding members of the Eugene Disaster Relief Trials Cargo Bike Obstacle Challenge Course.
So that sounds amazing, and I know a little bit about it, but can you describe, besides that excellent title, can you describe a little bit more about, for our listeners, what that event looks like?
Absolutely. So the event itself, it's really exciting. And it started out in Portland in 2012. But basically what it is folks got together and thought, if we really had a major catastrophic earthquake here in the Pacific Northwest, we're going to be without access to fuel. Maybe our vehicles, our response vehicles, or our personal vehicles are going to be damaged. And we might be you know, dealing with debris in the streets, and we know that we'll still need to be getting around town to, you know, bring resources and help our neighbors and things like that. And, you know, what better way to do that than by bicycle? And really, we've seen that borne out as truth in many instances around the world. So really what we have here is a proof of concept, this race. And you've got individuals who have the long tails, or maybe they're just hauling a bike trailer behind them. But basically, the event itself is about a 20-mile race in terms of length, but riders also deal with checkpoints along the way, which are obstacles or challenges they have to overcome, maybe literally overcome a barrier or ride through water or pick up a delicate medical supply, which represented by an egg or something like that.
So the obstacles are based on what might, in your experience of studying Katrina and what you do for work, are developed around what people would actually need in a disaster, or what they might have to get through in a natural disaster.
Yeah, this year we're partnering. We've got a lot of partners on our event this year, which is really exciting to see it be a fully, you know, engaged community event. But we're partnering with our local utility district, EWEB, Eugene Water and Electric Board, and they wanted to integrate some sort of learning about, some sort of teaching moment about the distance you're supposed to give a downed power line. So one part of an obstacle course will be that there'll be a simulated power line down, and the riders have to overcome that obstacle but stay at least 20 feet away. So there's a lot of learning, I think, that we hope that will go on for the riders and the families that participate as well.
We
base the challenges sort of on, you know, it's the debris or it's a water feature, or they have to haul a certain weight of cargo for a certain amount of time.
And that event is October 11th? Or?
Yes, it is. Our event is October 11th, which is a Saturday, down here at one of our favorite parks in Eugene, Alton Baker Park. And the way we've designed the course this year, we hope will be a lot more exciting for the folks that are not riders but are the observers this year. We're going to have a hub and spoke concept. So riders start out at the park. They go out and they do one or two challenges along the way, and they come back, and they've got one or two challenges at the hub. And then they go back out and do one or two other challenges. And I'm being a little vague, because in case we have any Eugene listeners that are also riders, I don't want to give away all the secrets for the race this year.
Well, but I love that concept of the hub, both for spectators who may not be racing, but also because often in emergencies you've got that Red Cross that's in the middle of things. You're
exactly
going to be bringing supplies or resources back to a place where people are gathered. So that's kind of brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. And that's exactly, you know, our thought behind it. And we are including one of the hospitals in town is involved in terms of being a checkpoint. Like I said, the Eugene Water and Electric Board, the Red Cross is involved. So a lot of city emergency management from Eugene is involved. So we've got a lot of the actual, the real structure that would be involved in an emergency response is also participating. The CERT volunteers, the Community Emergency Response Team, they are our biggest group of volunteers. We've got about 40 people signed up to volunteer, and the city is using this as an exercise to test their mobile emergency operations center equipment.
Wow, that's really amazing that the city and the utilities and the hospitals are getting on board with this kind of, you know, as a cyclist, I think of it as a fun or funny. It is, but it's a serious event. They're almost using it as a test run for
Absolutely.
Everything. That's amazing.
Absolutely. It's, I think it really, for me as an emergency manager, what I have loved so much about this event is that there's this community, the cycling community, which is already so robust here in Oregon and here in Eugene. And like you were saying, it's about fun, and it is about spreading the message and the accessibility of bicycles, and then to just sort of drizzle in a little bit of the emergency preparedness information to that community. That's really exciting for me as an emergency manager, to sort of hook a new community on the emergency preparedness message, but not as a, you know, it's something new and different and scary and it's cumbersome and complicated, but actually by riding bicycles, you are already taking steps to be more prepared in an emergency. You already know how to get around town in multiple different ways. If there's construction, or if you have a flat tire, you know how to fix that. You know how to haul your kids and groceries and get to school on time. So, you know, sort of making that emergency preparedness information, a message, more accessible to the community too. That's why I think this event has really been a success in Eugene and also around the country. One of the stories that just gives me chills is in Boulder, Colorado, last year in 2013, they were planning their DRT, their disaster relief trial, but they had to call it off because they had those floods.
Right, because they had a disaster.
And people who were on the bicycles deployed to their neighborhoods to assist, to spread information, to help people. So they actually, it was a, not an exercise, it was a real incident.
I was in San Francisco during the 1989 earthquake with my daughter. We were actually on a ferry going to Sausalito. And then when we returned to our friend's home, south of Market, you know, everything was destroyed. And having bikes was wonderful because we could get food. We, with a few neighbors, we went and got medical supplies for a few elderly people. So the bicycle definitely has an important role. You mentioned some historical cases. Can you talk about some of those where bicycles have been used?
I don't know that I have any specific examples, but I think that you see, you know, communities where there's massive physical impacts to the community, to the infrastructure, specifically the roads, that you can't get the emergency response vehicles in. You know, supplies might have to be airlifted, and so the bicycles just make that response so much more accessible, and individuals can participate, as well as sort of the larger structure, you know, whether that be Red Cross or a National Response Agency, because a lot of people just have bicycles already around the world. It's a much more prevalent form of transportation around the world than it may be here in the States currently. So it's something that individuals can use even to evacuate. I know there are a couple of communities in the U.S. which are looking at bicycle evacuation plans, and what does that look like? So I think it, incorporating bicycles into emergency response and emergency recovery plans really changes the conversation to be more about how do individuals in the community play a part and what can individuals do, as opposed to, well, it's all about the, you know, a federal structure coming in, or you have to wait for these external resources. The resources are in our community. All response is local response.
Well, and I like the idea.
First responders happen locally.
I think, I mean, just from my very limited perspective, I think what we saw happen in with Katrina was that, you know, FEMA came in, and that didn't make everything better. In some cases, it made it worse. In the initial response, it was not necessarily handled really well, and that I feel like with a lot of this emergency planning and preparedness, especially with involving the community, we're positioning ourselves as community members to have more power and a voice when things do happen, instead of just being susceptible to whatever government agencies are deciding that I need to do.
Absolutely. And you allow the community to be its own, to really connect the resources that already exist here. For example, after the success of last year's DRT, the emergency manager in Eugene said, you know, with the search there and the bicycle folks there, he said, this is a perfect combination, a perfect marriage of these two skill sets. So the city was working on how to activate, or I guess activate is the right word, the CERT teams with bicycle resources. So either sort of creating a bike corps and assigning, having, you know, identify one or two people in each CERT group that is their bicycle resource, and vice versa. So we have, you know, finding out which CERTs are bicyclists and training bicyclists to be CERTs. So really enhancing both resources in the community.
Our time is up. We could talk for much longer. We've been a long time. Yeah, we've been talking to Emma Stalker of Eugene, and I hope we don't face these tsunamis and earthquakes and other disasters. But if we do, it's good to know that the city of Eugene and also other places in Oregon are preparing. And it's even better to know that bicycles have a very important role to play. So,
Emma,
absolutely.
Emma Stalker, can you let our listeners know if they want to be involved with the Eugene Cargo Bike and Disaster Relief Trials, where can they find more information on that?
Yeah, thank you. You can find us on our website is eugenedrt.com. We also have a pretty active Facebook page, and that's just search for Eugene DRT. We have a couple of Portland writers that were with us last year and are coming back, so that's pretty exciting. And just a sort of note of pride, one of our Eugene writers actually won the Portland DRT this year. So we have a little bit of pride invested in this event as well.
That's so good. And for our listeners, it's the disaster relief trials are really fun to participate in as well as watch. So if you have a chance to go down to Eugene and check those out on October 11th, I highly recommend it. And if in case of a natural disaster, not only your bicycle is going to be important, so is the radio. And that's why we want to turn it over to Pledge Central and have you be a part of this community during this membership drive.
Thank you, Emma.
Thanks very much. And Justin here and Pear here, and we're very grateful for this vital programming, especially on this very special day, our first day of the fall membership drive. And we're doing special programming on climate change today called Turning the Tide. And we're hoping that you, dear listeners, all around the region, all around the world, will take a small amount of responsibility to make sure that these signals are pumping out this vital information. You can do that by calling toll-free 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KBOO, or online at KBOO.FM. And this just in, we have got a climate change action pack that is designed to inspire you, dear listeners, to move to your phone. This is one day only. And if you'll start a $15 a month electronic funds transfer. This isn't all of it, but it includes all audio from today's all-day special on Turning the Tide, exclusive KBOO interview with Naomi Klein, who's going to be in the studio a little later today, Corey Morningstar, independent investigative journalist, Sharman Apt-Russell, whom we heard from earlier, Arun Gupta, Naomi Oreskes, George Marshall, special bonus audio, the March for Climate Justice. Last week, a copy of Disruption, the DVD we heard from earlier, a seed packet for attracting pollinators, a tree planted in your name by Friends of Trees, and a subscription to Yes Magazine, the Journal of Positive Futures. All of that and more in your $15 a month climate change action pack. Call right now, won't you? 877-500-5266 to say thank you to the Bike Show Collective and all of the volunteer programmers who are bringing you the news and information you're not supposed to know.
Or online anywhere in the world, KBOO.FM. Or if you're right close by, come on down and see us at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. A little modest building with a nice mural in front. Come on in, visit with us, see where your money is going, see our equipment and our record library, meet the people, have a little coffee with us, and give us some money. Lay some money on us, and we have people that can walk you through, make it very easy to do that electronic funds transfer.
It's true. We're hoping to add more of those new sustaining memberships. Mm-hmm. And, you know, really in the final analysis, you're not actually giving us the money. You are placing it in a public trust here that stands as a monument. It's a training ground. It is an education zone. It's a radio university where the people in here who are making the product are learning and the people who are receiving our broadcast are learning. So everyone's a winner. We're not asking you to give it to us. We're asking you to place it in trust in service of the community. And it stands here. It's an investment in your entire community. And it's not a mystery. It doesn't fly away to Washington to be used in the drone wars. It stays right here as a monument at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue and is open for you to get involved. Come and check in on it any time you like. But we really are hoping to add new members to the KBOO Good Book. And we're hoping you'll do that in the form of a sustaining membership, making a monthly contribution. That $15 a month to get the Climate Change Action Pack works out to, I believe, $180 a year. But that $15 a month, that works out to be a pretty modest, doable contribution. And then we marry that money together with other many monies. and then you have the nation's, you have a budget, and you have essentially the nation's oldest independent community radio station serving the community. It's day one of a 10-day membership drive, and we have about $70,000 left to do. That means we want to stay focused and make sure that everyone is doing their part. 10 days, $7,000 a day. I haven't done the math on how much per hour, but just a few phone calls does it. Why not consider 1 hour's wage each month? And in fact, when I see all the motion right now around 15 now raising the minimum wage, that seems like a perfect way to consider doing this climate change action pack. That's 15 a month. And hopefully that everyone who is working at a minimum wage position will soon be able to offer that $15 a month as their 1 hour's wage. Call right now, 877-500-5266. There are too many people to thank for making every hour of this broadcast possible, but I would like to thank the restaurants again this hour who have been donating food to provide to our volunteers. Thank you to the Roxy at 1121 Southwest Stark in the heart of the Glamour District since 1994, theroxydiner.com. Cannon's Rib Express at 5410 Northeast 33rd Avenue, serving hickory smoked barbecue and vegetarian fare, cannonsribexpress.com. Thank you to Russell Street Barbecue, 325 Northeast Russell Street, committed to using sustainable meat, fish, and produce and offering a variety of sauces and sides, vegetarian options, beer, wine, and full bar. RussellStreetBarbecue.com. And Grocery Getter Organic, specializing in home delivery of organic groceries, independent and locally owned. More information on Grocery Getter at ggetter.com. These folks have done what they can do to support community radio in Portland and for the world. Won't you now consider doing that very same thing by starting or renewing your electronic funds transfer? 877-500-KBOO.
Or 20 Southeast 8th in the heart of the Glamour District here in Portland. Come on down and see us. You won't regret it. We'll take you on a tour of the station, and you can just see where your money is going. You can see the people hard at work. As a member, you can become part of the station. You can take classes in radio production, radio writing, all kinds of really interesting stuff. And you can work on committees that help run the station, like the program committee. We can... all kinds of things.
By any means necessary, you'll also be supporting the only bike show around, and we're very grateful to get to hand it back to them for a few more minutes. In the meantime, we're standing by for your phone call, dear listener, 877-500-KBOO.
And then she falls in love with this virile army officer. Thank you. You're listening to KBO's Bike Show with your host, Tori Bortman and Alon Robb. Our engineer has been Tammy Dean. Thank you, Tori and Tammy. Today is the KBO's Day of Broadcast dedicated to turning the tide on climate change. And we'd like to thank our listeners, cyclists and also future cyclists, for playing such an important role in this movement. Let the wheels of change keep rolling.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from City Bikes, a worker-owned, cooperatively run, new and used bicycle sales and service shop with two locations on Southeast Ankeny near KBOO. Open 7 days a week for your bicycle commuting needs and online at citybikes.coop. This KBOO program has also been made possible in part by Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco-brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver, available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. And we thank you very much for listening to the bike show and listening to this great programming we're having for the beginning of our fall pledge drive. It's our special day called Turning the Tide on Climate Change, Cutting Edge Thinkers and Activists on How to Avert a Global Catastrophe. And we're going to hear a panel of several of those activists. And I'll give you all the details about that. It's called Apocalypse How, Climate Change, the Political Economy of Energy, and Reigniting the Radical Imagination. And I'll give you all the details momentarily as soon as we listen to the KBOO Noon News headlines. Thanks for tuning in to KBOO.
This is KBOO Headline News at noon for Wednesday, October 1st, 2014. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson.
In local news, California Governor Jerry Brown is likely to sign a bill imposing a statewide ban on single-use plastic bags effective July 2015. This will be the nation's first ban on single-use plastic bags to reduce littering, primarily in waterways. The law, which will prohibit large grocery stores from using the bags and will expand to smaller stores in 2016.
California expects to see the number of middle-skilled jobs grow significantly by 2017. A part of this growth is fueled by the increasing number of retirees and the larger number of health care workers required to care for them. Nursing represents the kind of jobs becoming available, with better pay and not requiring extensive education. Nearly 25,000 new middle-skilled jobs are expected to appear over the next 3 years in the California area.
In national news, on Tuesday, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services announced plans to spend $9 million to pay for legal representation of some of the 2,600 unaccompanied minors surging into the U.S. from south of the border. The monies will assist the children who ordinarily would not be entitled to publicly funded legal representation and to secure legal asylum or other kinds of protection.
The European Commission opened a formal investigation Tuesday into a sweetheart tax deal between Apple Computer and the Irish government, initiated when Apple was a relatively new corporation. The investigation is part of an increasing closer look being taken by the EC into state aid being received by large American companies like Apple, Google, Amazon, and Facebook that may interfere with internal European markets. It appears that Apple may have to repay tens of millions of euros they received in illegal state aid, which is actually a relatively small amount compared to the gigantic revenues they realized.
In international news, on Tuesday, the European Commission announced new measures worth 165 million euros to assist vegetable and fruit growers negatively impacted by the recent ban on vegetable and fruits. This resulted from a one-year embargo on meat, fish, dairy, fruit, vegetables imposed by Russia on the U.S., European Union, Canada, Austria, and Norway in retaliation for Western sanctions of Russia's role in the Ukrainian crisis. EU farm exports to Russia are roughly 10% of the bloc's agricultural sales.
32 Turkish truckers and their vehicles were taken hostage by ISIS rebels last month. While lengthy imprisonment, torture,